Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are things that we take for granted in our contemporary lives. Clean water, flushing toilets, streetlights, cars, fresh food, knowing the time. Things so basic to how we function that we don't even consider their origins. Stephen Johnson does. His perspective on history is not about wars and great men. Instead, he looks at the hobbyists, the obsessive tinkerers, the garage mechanics, and sometimes college dropouts. People whose ideas set off a series of events, inventions, and outcomes that brought us to how we live today. Stephen Johnson is author of several best-selling books on innovation, most recently How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World. And he's host of the PBS series of the same name. It's now available for viewing online in its entirety. And Stephen Johnson, welcome to Word of Mouth.
That's nice to be here.
So you didn't choose the steam engine or nuclear fission or the assembly line, but time, glass, cold, sound, clean, and light. Tell me about these decisions.
I'm glad you named them all because I often blank on one or two of them when I'm actually asked to name them myself, so that's good.
It's like the Seven Dwarfs.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Oh, I forgot Sleepy. One of the things that I wanted to do or we wanted to do with the show is to not focus on innovations that seem very high-tech, right? We talk about innovation all the time in our society, but it's always about the latest gadget and, you know, the latest smartphone app and things like that. And so what I was interested in is things that have become so integrated into our lives that we no longer think of them as innovations in themselves, like glass, for instance.
Well, let's start with one of those most profound notions and the most far-reaching, time, which our concept of which has changed dramatically over the past 150 years when agrarian concepts of time were replaced by clocks, or more importantly, the pocket watch. These are the efforts of a man who was called the Lunatic of Boston in his time. Who was he? What was his story?
A surprising number of people in the book were called the Lunatic of Boston.
Yeah, Boston figures primarily.
It simultaneously generates interesting thinkers, but they are ridiculed by their peers. So it's this guy, Denison, who came up with this idea for basically kind of mass producing a watch. So up until around 1850, 1860, pocket watches were in circulation, but they were extremely expensive. And this guy, Denison, came up with this system basically modeled after the, kind of industrial production lines that were starting to appear for manufacturing things like guns. And he built this watch. It was called the Ellery watch. And it was really the first kind of breakthrough watch. It cost about a tenth of what other pocket watches cost at the time. And, it was kind of the kind of first draft of what then would become the, the kind of Sony Walkman and the iPod more than 100 years later.
And it was also called the Soldier's Watch because so many soldiers had them during the Civil War. One of the results is that punctuality over a couple of decades becomes a social virtue, which was problematic at a time when hundreds of towns across the country had their own time, as did the 50 railroads operating in the U.S. That's what we learn from your book. How was this fixed?
Yeah, I love this is one of my favorite things because this is a classic example of this. Is we never think of coordinating time as an innovation, right? But as you said, until in the United States, until around 1880, every single town was on its own time zone. So you would do a local reading of the sun. The point at which the sun was the highest in the sky was noon. And that meant that, as you went from town to town, it would be 2 minutes ahead or 5 minutes behind the last town. And the key thing about this is that nobody even noticed that this was a problem. It genuinely wasn't a problem for an extremely long period of time because nobody needed to coordinate schedules between towns with that level of accuracy. It didn't matter if you lost a minute or two going from town to town because it took you an hour and a half on your horse to get from one town to the other. And then a new technology came along that exposed this problem or made it a problem in the first place, which was the railroad. The railroad suddenly meant that people were traveling from town to town in very kind of meticulously choreographed time schedules. And suddenly it was just incredibly hard to figure out what time it was. And so someone needed to solve this. And they'd kind of come up with the idea of standardizing time in Canada and in the UK. But in the U.S., it took quite a while. It was this guy named William Allen, who was a kind of railway clerk, basically, who got obsessed with this idea of building a time zone system. It was amazingly controversial. So all these during the period, this period, there were all these kind of angry letters to the editor written by people in towns across the country that are saying, Cincinnati will never adopt this artificial devil's time. You know, time is meant to be set by the sun as God intended it. But eventually people came around, and actually the original time zone system that lasted for about 30 or 40 years, the edges of each division that now basically run along the edges of the states. Originally, in Allen's map, it was defined by the railroad termination points, not by the states, which shows you how important the rail system was to our sense of time in the late 19th century.
William Allen triggers this kind of chain of events, right? And this happens often in this book, in this series. One person trying to solve a problem, getting something stuck in their craw. One such man I think of, Edward Leon Scott de Martinville. He's a
nice pronunciation.
Well, you know, I did my best. A French bookseller, essential in recording sound. Now, tell us more about him and his innovation.
So he invented a brilliant machine. It was called the phonautograph, for recording audio, for capturing sound waves out of the air in the early 1850s, which is more than 20 years before Edison invents the phonograph. But the reason we've never heard of him is that he failed to include one key feature, which was playback. There was no way to listen to the audio that had been recorded. You could just record these little sound waves, but there was no way to actually hear what you'd recorded. And it wasn't like he was trying to add this feature and couldn't figure out how to do it. It never even occurred to him. He was just, as I said, it was kind of in his blind spot. Basically, his technology didn't take off, and he more or less died penniless. But two things happened. First off, a number of years later, another inventor was tinkering with Scott's device, and that inventor was Alexander Graham Bell, inventing the telephone. So the phonautograph failed on its own, but it contained the seeds of this other technology that would take off. And the other cool thing about this story is that a group of audio historians, they got together a couple years ago and they found Scott's recordings, and they scanned them into a computer and got the computer to play them back. And initially they thought they were hearing a little girl singing, but then they realized they were playing it too fast, and they slowed it down and realized it was Scott himself. Half a century later, he finally got playback added to his phonautograph.
Well, and there's just a wonderful moment in the PBS series when you play that audio. Let's just hear a little bit of it. We're talking with Stephen Johnson about some of the innovations that were so big that we don't even think about them. He is the host of the new PBS series, How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World, and a book of the same name. Stephen Johnson, are these innovations really the result of the lone inventor? I mean, if Edward Leon Scott had not invented the phonoautograph, would it have just been somebody else?
You know, it's a great question. I spent a lot of time trying to get this right. It's a tricky thing, particularly thinking about the format that I was working with, because I was developing this as a show on PBS and then as a book. And in a funny way, television kind of wants you to have a hero. To have the person you can see. But a lot of the message of this project is that, you know, that invention is much more of a collective, collaborative network kind of affair, and that the single inventor is actually very unusual. In fact, there's a whole segment in both projects where we talk about Edison and how every school kid learns that Edison invented the light bulb. And in fact, Edison didn't invent the light bulb. Mm-hmm. There were 20 people who were working on the light bulb in various forms, almost all of whom hit upon most of the key ingredients that Edison hit upon. And Edison was aware of those people and building on their ideas. And as you kind of implied, there's an inevitability to that invention. Someone was going to invent the air conditioner by the, you know, kind of first years of the 20th century. It happened to be this guy, Willis Carrier, but there were other people working on it. And, you know, it was going to be invented by someone. It was just, in a sense, in the air.
With all of these positive changes, of course, you know, there is a less glowing side to some of them, especially for our Paleolithic era human bodies, you know. How have these innovations changed the way that we eat, live, sleep? What were the implications as far as you found in those areas?
Yeah, well, our bodies are not as evolving as quickly as the technology, mm-hmm. as our culture is, basically. And so occasionally you get this kind of lag. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that until artificial light came along in kind of the abundance of the late 19th century, where you had kind of gas lamps and then the electric light bulb in kind of the 1890s and at the turn of the century. Up until that point, in particularly in the winter, people basically would have what they call two sleeps. So they would go to bed, and as soon as it got dark, which, you know, in the Northeast could be, you know, 5 or 5:30 or something like that. And so they go to bed at 6 because there was nothing to do, basically. There wasn't enough light to kind of make it worthwhile to stay up. You had a couple of candles, and it was expensive to have those candles burning and so on. So people would go to sleep, but they weren't, you know, they didn't want to sleep for 14 hours. And so they would wake up in the middle of the night and be up for an hour or two and have a snack, you know, hang out, maybe light a candle and read a little bit, or, you know, procreate or, you know, use the facilities, whatever. Here, I'm trying to be gentle about this. And then they would go back to sleep and they would have a second sleep. And then all of a sudden artificial light came around, and suddenly after dark, your home, just your home alone or the outside world, was filled with all these things that you could do, you know. And you were like, well, I'm going to stay up and read initially, or I'm going to go out to a restaurant, or I'm going to go out and see a movie, or now I've got television and radio and I'm going to stay up and do that. And so we pushed back our bedtimes. And the argument is that when some of us suffer from insomnia, where we wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning, it's really that kind of the echo of this natural rhythm of sleep that we'd had for presumably thousands and thousands of years, mm-hmm. that has been artificially interrupted by this light cycle of the electric light bulb.
And in that conversation about light, you point out that the use of whale oil light made it possible for people like Jane Austen and Herman Melville and Emily Dickinson to stay up and write at night. I mean, just one of these things we would never think of. Do you have a sort of like craziest revelation of triggered actions during this series for you?
Well, I think actually the whale oil that powered, you know, kind of artificial light in that period of spermaceti oil from the skull of the sperm whale. And it was basically the cleanest and purest and kind of whitest light you could find. It was the state of the art in kind of lighting technology from about 1730, 1740 until around 1840 or so. And this is one of these places actually where there's a really interesting kind of disjunction, it would seem, from the state of the art in other technologies. So to extract this whale oil, they would first capture a sperm whale and kill the whale, which is incredibly hard to do. But then they would have the whale up on the deck and they would cut a hole in the whale's skull. And the youngest boy on ship, who could be like 12 or 13 years old, would then crawl into the skull of the whale and extract this whale oil with a bucket. And so this is in an age when, you know, people were inventing the railroad and the telegraph and all these advanced, you know, technologies, and the steam engine, you know, is rewriting the kind of history of the world at that point. But simultaneously with all of that, the most advanced form of artificial lighting involved a 13-year-old crawling around in a whale skull.
Who'd been dead probably for a little while.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems wrong that those two things would be happening at the same time. But sometimes you get advances in one field that kind of jump ahead and the other field kind of lags behind.
There are a lot of big questions that are circulating, of course, in our culture now about whether, you know, we're so scattered or stressed out by always being accessible, being always on, using our smartphones, for example. These innovations have changed the way we work, the way we live. And with your long zoom of history, are we going to work these kind of questions out?
Well, I think, we're better at projecting forward, I think, and thinking about the unintended consequences. It's very hard to do that. I mean, I've spent a lot of time looking at innovation, but every time anybody asks me to, like, you know, wear my futurist hat and describe, you know, what life is going to be like in 20 or 30 years, I always kind of politely decline, because I'm like, if you look back at this book, you know, and one of the big lessons is that, you know, you invent one thing and it ends up triggering all these changes that you would have never anticipated in advance. And that's going to keep happening. But I think we're a little bit better. I think there's a lot more, for instance, writing about technology today that is thinking about the cultural impact of these new tools and not just, you know, kind of reviewing them as products. You know, I remember when I first started writing about technology, if you looked at people writing about computers, it was just, you know, it was just product reviews. You know, mm-hmm. It was like, oh, there's a new Mac and I give it 4 stars. And the idea that these machines were going to ripple out through society and change the way we listen to music and change the business models of all these creative industries and affect the way we communicate with our friends and the way that families form and national border, all these, you know, issues now that we kind of take it for granted that technology is going to shape our lives in this way. I don't think that was as much a part of the conversation 25 years ago, say. And so I think we don't have any easy answers to this, but we were at least, you know, asking the right questions now.
Well, Stephen Johnson, just fascinating. It just triggers so many questions, and I appreciate your time today.
Oh, my pleasure. Enjoyed it a lot.
Stephen Johnson, his most recent book is also a PBS series called How We Got to Now, 6 Innovations That Made the Modern World. There are links to find more, including video trailers from the series, at wordofmouthradio.org. Ferguson, Missouri is bracing for a grand jury verdict in the shooting of Michael Brown due sometime this month, again sparking conversations about race and racism in communities across the country. Up next on Word of Mouth, a filmmaker asks whether a fruitful discussion can really happen if the privileged majority can't name what it means to be white. Stay with us as we learn about the Whiteness Project. That's coming up after the news.